So I want to start by reading something from Bhagavad Gita as it is, and we're only going to talk for about half an hour, and then I'd like some of you to say something, ask something, or make some comments, say something challenging to make it a little more interactive. And if you want to ask anything, you can just say anything you want. It doesn't matter. So this is the 11th verse of the 4th chapter of Bhagavad Gita as it is. Yeyatamam prapadyante tam sthai bhavajamyaham mama varmai vartante manushi parthasarvasaha. And Prabhupada's translation reads, as all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects. O son of Partha, I'll read it again. As all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects. O son of Prita. And Prabhupada's purport is, everyone is searching for Krishna in the different aspects of his manifestations. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is partially realized in his impersonal Brahmajyoti effulgence and as the all-pervading super soul dwelling within everything, including the particles of atoms. But Krishna is fully realized only by his pure devotees. Consequently, Krishna is the object of everyone's realization, and thus anyone and everyone is satisfied according to one's desire to have him. In the transcendental world also, Krishna reciprocates with pure devotees in the transcendental attitude, just as the devotee wants him. One devotee may want Krishna as Supreme Master. Another as his personal friend, another as his son, and still another as his lover. Krishna rewards all the devotees equally according to their different intensities of love for him. In the material world, the same reciprocations of feelings are there, and they are equally exchanged by the Lord with the different types of worshippers. The pure devotees, both here and in the transcendental abode, associate with him in person and are able to render personal service to the Lord and thus derive transcendental bliss in his loving service. As for those who are impersonalists and who want to commit spiritual suicide by annihilating the individual existence of the living entity, Krishna helps also by absorbing them into his effulgence. Such impersonalists do not agree to accept the eternal blissful personality of Godhead. Consequently, they cannot relish the bliss of transcendental personal service to the Lord, having extinguished their individuality. Some of them who are not firmly situated even in the impersonal existence return to this material world to exhibit their dormant desires for activities. They are not admitted into the spiritual planet, but they are again given a chance to act on the material planet. For those who are fruitive workers, the Lord awards desired results of their prescribed duties as the Yogeshwara. And those who are yogis seeking mystic powers are awarded such powers. In other words, everyone is dependent for success upon his mercy alone. And all kinds of spiritual processes are but different degrees of success on the same path. Unless, therefore, one comes to the highest perfection of Krishna consciousness, all attempts remain imperfect. As is stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 2.3.10, Akama Sarva Kamova Moksha Karma Udharati Tivreya Bhakti Yogena Yajeta Purusham Param. Whether one is without desire, the condition of the devotees, or is desirous of all fruitive results, or is after liberation, one should, with all efforts, try to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead for complete perfection, culminating in Krishna consciousness. As all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects. O son of Prita. The key word in this verse is accordingly. It it tells us that Krishna reciprocates perfectly with us according to our desire to have him. So if we want 10%, Krishna is willing to give us 10% of himself. If we want 20%, Krishna is willing to give 20% of himself. If we want 80%, Krishna is willing to give 80% of himself. And if we want 100%, 100%, Krishna is willing to give us that. Of course, Krishna can give 100%, and still there's another 100% left, because he is by definition unlimited. So this may raise many questions. How is the Supreme Lord, who is the omnipotent and omniscient and omnipresent factor, if the Supreme Controller, able to give 20% or only 10%? If he's in complete control, why doesn't he always give everything? Why doesn't he prevent evil from happening? As I said earlier, the key word in this verse is accordingly. There are many different ways in which people surrender to Krishna. And one of the ways in which people surrender to Krishna is partial surrender. That is, they're willing to give 1% or 2% or 5% or 10% to Krishna. And Krishna rewards them accordingly. So he's let very evil people sometimes work their magical tricks in decimating large numbers of people. Very tyrannical people have lived in these last few hundred years or few thousand years, who have committed all sorts of atrocities. Even when Krishna was present on the earth 5,000 years ago, there were many tyrants, many people who were opposed to him, who wanted to do away with Krishna and his whole family. And Krishna was, as promises in Bhagavad Gita, very capable of doing away with inimical forces on this planet. Not just Kamsa, but there were many who came to do away with Krishna. We live in a time and in a part of the world where people in general are atheistic. They want to do away with Krishna. They don't like to hear about any religion or God from any source. Not just that they're against Muslims, but they're against Hindus, they're against Christians, they're against Jesus, they're against anything spiritual. So it is a matter of attitude, in a sense. Even when Krishna was present, even when Lord Chaitanya was present on this planet, there were so many people that were completely against them. They were averse to their activities. They wanted to destroy them. They tried. Bhutana tried. Agasura tried. And many tried to do away with Krishna and his friends. But they all failed. Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu all tried to do away with Krishna. They considered him an enemy. What is an enemy? Well, we might say that the world in which we live, the world of illusion, or the world of Maya, is an enemy. And we're fighting sometimes within our own selves against Maya, against illusory desires that are tempting us into doing things that we know we shouldn't do, but we do them anyway. This is the plight of everyone who comes to this material world. We're allured by Maya in many different forms. It may be beautiful in nature, it may be beautiful music, it may be beautiful paintings or beautiful people, but we're allured to stay in this material world. And the theology of Krishna consciousness is that we're here because we wanted to enjoy that illusory happiness, that happiness that cannot be ever really completely grasped in this lifetime. That's our reason for being here. It's an illusory thing. So when Krishna says that he awards our desires accordingly, he's actually reading what we're thinking. He's reading our minds. Sometimes we're very impressed with someone who can read minds. has that special power or mystic ability. But Krishna has that ability all the time. And for this reason, he has many enemies. People don't want to have their minds read. So people are trying to do away with Krishna or God or organized religion. I remember when the Pope came here, not the present Pope, but the one who passed away recently, came to Australia. And every newspaper, at least every newspaper in Sydney, that's where I was at the time, was writing against the Pope. They didn't like the Pope. It was this, it was that, and the church was hypocritical, it was corrupt, it was beyond help, and the Pope was just trying to push his agenda. This was what we were all reading, being spoon-fed in Sydney. At the same time, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people turned out to see this great man, the head of the Roman Catholic Church, because he had come all the way to Australia in his bulletproof car. But people were against him. People were trying to do away with him. So in that sense, the attitude of a devotee is unique. And it's not a popular one. It's not popular in the sense that people would rather walk down a busy street and buy the latest CD on offer, or turn into the latest movie theater, or consort with their favorite movie star, or watch TV for 5 or 6 hours a day, pet the dog and drink beer. So Krishna consciousness is not so popular because it's aiming at something very different. There's a professor in Oxford who was saying how difficult it is. He teaches Hinduism and Indology, and he's been doing it for many, many years, professor there. And he was saying it's very, very difficult to do anything. He was glorifying one devotee in Oxford, a devotee named Shonaka Rishi, who was in charge of something called the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. And he was saying it's very, very difficult that what he's done to establish an institution of higher learning about anything spiritual. And because every endeavor requires four things, as we learn: land, labor, capital, and organization. Land, labor, capital, and organization. And this Oxford Center for Hindu Studies had no capital, had no land, just some enthusiasm. That's all. No land, and there was labor because there was enthusiasm, but no capital. So this fellow who's in his 60s was saying that it's harder to raise money for an academic institution than it is even to raise money for a temple. Because there's nothing tangible at the end of the day, nothing people can see except maybe a few letters after a few names. That's all. So he was lamenting how difficult it is. And when I was reading this verse, I was remembering that the founder of the Krishna movement, Srila Prabhupada, was always, he said that I have one fault. This is one thing he used to say. And his fault, he said, was that he could never do anything small. And one time I stood with him in Regent Park, and he said, we should build a temple over this canal. It's called the Grand Union Canal. It still exists, and it's an artery in which goods are transported. It was built before railroads came into existence. And there was a series of canals, like in Holland, that move all over Great Britain, that transported goods. So he said that we should build a temple over this canal. Imagine over a canal in Regent Park to have a waterway running through a temple, through your house. There's a house, I think it was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, famous architect. In Pennsylvania, it's called Falling Water House. You may have seen pictures of it. There's a stream that runs through this house, and there's a waterfall that comes out. Can you imagine how difficult it would be to maintain a waterway through your living room? What kind of intelligence you would need to deal with all the wildlife and the insects and the ants and all the flora and fauna that would be in your house? But such a house is built. So Prabhupada wanted to do this. And he said that we should have glass walls in the lower part of the building so that people driving by could see the deities. Because Regent Park is in London is located on a major thoroughfare. This part of it, where the canal is, this section. It's where, there's a place called Swiss Cottage. Some of you may know. I think the name of the road is Prince Edward Road or Prince Albert Road. Anyway, he wanted people to be able to drive by, look through the glass, and see the deities. So in this way, he never wanted anything small done. He just couldn't do anything small. And one time, I recall that he wanted, there was a windmill in San Francisco at the end of Golden Gate Park, where it's abuts against the Pacific Ocean. And there was a windmill that was in a dilapidated condition, because probably San Francisco was going to be a sister city of Amsterdam or something like that, but it was toppled over. So he proposed that we, devotees of ISKCON, should approach the city of San Francisco and say that we would like to resurrect and renovate this windmill in exchange for the right to build a temple that would overlook the Pacific Ocean at the end of the park. And that was in 1967. The proposal to build something over the Grand Union Canal came a bit later, 1977, or 1975 maybe. So that was something that Prabhupada wanted. Big, beautiful, architecturally stimulating buildings so that the public would be able to appreciate the cultural aspects of Krishna consciousness through the arts, through architecture. So that they would be able to see something magnificent, something that was irresistibly attractive. And as you know, in all of the books that were printed during Prabhupada's time with us, he had artists paint pictures. And beautiful pictures are in all of the books, the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Bhagavad Gita, and Krishna book. Beautiful paintings. Because it so happens that in this age, people tend to be very visually oriented. They're not so much going to memorize philosophical points, but they'll remember pictures. There's even memory techniques to remember, like a list of 25 or 30 unrelated objects that rely upon creating images in the mind. This is the way people learn today in Kali Yuga. They learn languages this way. There's even a course for learning Hindi in which one has to visualize what a word means. Like kamra is a word that I think it means room, is that correct?
Yes.
So the vision is that you think of a room full of cameras, kamra. So that's a technique. So visually interesting, visually easy to remember things were very much a part of the publication of books like the Bhagavad Gita as it is. It is this kind of vision that enables people to reciprocate with Krishna, to have an exchange with Him, to have a relationship with Krishna. Many religions talk about God, but few go into depth. Who God is, where He lives, what He does, what His likes are, what He looks like, how we can perceive Him, and where we can perceive Him. But in the books of Krishna consciousness, all that theology is there. So, the books of Krishna consciousness are not just books that a particular group of people is interested in reading, not just another book of philosophy, but they're books about knowledge. They're books of very deep philosophy. They're books about Atma. And Westerners like me, we never heard of Atma before. It was a whole new concept that we're not the body, but there's another entity within the body called the Atma or the soul. That concept was that this entity is always happy. It's naturally happy. And that it survives the death experience. That we have to die at some point. Everybody has to die, right? But this thing, this Atma that's inside of us, is going to survive this experience and going to go on and on and on. So this concept of transmigration of this, of the Atma, of the soul, and the concept of karma, which is very mysterious, it's not a law, it's like a phenomenon that nobody can really, it's a phenomenon that nobody can really say what it is exactly. It has something to do with action and reaction, it has something to do with activities in the past, it has something to do with, there's national karma, there's individual karma. Sometimes I may have to become a ghost, that's a type of karma. So these concepts were all very new, and still are very new to Western people. But it's philosophy. And it's the kind of philosophy that even philosophers, many great people who we hold up on a pedestal, have read and found to be very, very engaging, very deep philosophy. So when Krishna says that I reward them accordingly, he's talking about rewards. That there's a benediction here. It's not just a matter of doing something out of duty, but it's doing something that is performing devotional service or engaging in bhakti yoga where there's a return. It's said in the Bhagavatam that if you donate or invest something, you're very lucky if you get an equal return. And if you're a little bit more lucky, you'll get return more than you invested. And if you're very, very fortunate, you'll get a return of unlimited multiplication. This is written in one of Prabhupada's purports in the Bhagavatam. He says that if you somehow or other give your hard-earned wealth to pure devotees, that you'll get unlimited return. This lifetime is very short. It's like the blinking of an eye in one sense. I mean, I'm getting a bit philosophical here, but everybody kind of knows that. And when Maharaj Yudhisthira was asked, what's the most wondrous thing in the world by the disembodied voice who happened to be Yamaraj, the Lord of Death? And he answered, we see death all around us. We see animals and insects dying. We're crushing ants every time we walk, every time we cook, every time we draw water, every time we breathe. Something is dying, a microbe, an insect, whatever. There's death all around us. We see our friends die. We see our family members die. We see our children die. We see our parents die. And yet, we think we're not going to die. That was the answer he gave as to what is the most wondrous phenomenon in the world. And that was the right answer. He was awarded, yes, this is the right answer. There were many questions that he was asked. But this is the very mysterious thing about life. We'll see our own very own mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters die, and yet we'll think we're not going to die. So, for a very short time, we may become a little philosophical when we're faced with a life-threatening illness or a death in the family, and then we become very philosophical. Yes, there is karma. There is transmigration of the soul. There is a soul. And then, the next day, it's completely forgotten. Or the next year, it's forgotten. Or a few years later, it's just part of life. It doesn't really matter. It's whether it happens. But it's not going to happen to me. Until it does happen. Then a reality switches on. There was a famous American author named William Saroyan. He wrote a book called The Human Comedy. It wasn't about comedy. It was about life. So he was diagnosed as having a terminal illness and told he'd only have 24 hours to live. And his comment was, he phoned the Associated Press, he was a very famous man, and he said, I always thought I was never going to die, and now what? Such a great, brilliant man was completely bewildered by the thought that he would have to leave this world. So when it said that Krishna rewards us, it's a reward that it's not limited to this lifetime, to this body, to this existence, but it's deeper. It's something that's eternal. So when Prabhupada was eager to build a temple in Regent Park, it would last beyond the lifetimes of many, many people. When he wrote books like this, like the Bhagavad Gita and other books, they would become documents for thousands of years into the future. That's the kind of reward that Krishna promises. It's not just an award. It's not just a medal of honor. It's not like winning a race or a football game. it's a true reward. It's something that stays with you all your life. So I'd like for any of you to just say something or ask anything. I'm going to give you a few minutes to think about it. I'd like to start thinking now because I'm going to be talking a little bit while you're thinking. And I hope you're not going to listen too closely, but think about what you want to ask or what's been said that stirs up some kind of query, some kind of thing that sounds hypocritical maybe, or something that sounds like it may not really be true, maybe false. There certainly is a lot of opposition. There certainly are a lot of people that are opposed to anything spiritual. We see it all around us. And although we're very happy to see people change from being atheistic to theistic, it doesn't happen very often. But when it does happen, it's an occasion to rejoice. It's very special. And it's said in Krishna consciousness that even people who are very stone-hearted can have their hearts melted by devotees and devotional service. This is an experience that many devotees have had, that we've encountered people who are downright inimical, that are very rude and very, very anti-God and anti-Krishna consciousness. But somehow, by coming into contact with devotees or books like this or beautiful temples, their hearts change. And this is a very miraculous thing, a very wonderful thing that happens. So it's not just a mechanical thing. Sometimes we say things and we just remember things and it becomes very mechanical. That's what education is about in one sense. We just have to learn things. We have to memorize things. You become a doctor, you have to memorize all the parts of the body. You become a computer scientist, you have to memorize all kinds of initials. And the way that the software works, you have to learn it. But a reward from Krishna consciousness is something that goes way beyond this lifetime, way beyond computer science, way beyond the body. So, anybody? Please. Yes.
Maharaj, it seems like some elevated devotees are really surrendering to Krishna, but it seems like they're going through a lot of suffering. So one may think, you know, how are they getting rewarded accordingly? They're going through so much suffering, even though they're surrendering so much.
What kind of suffering?
I don't know. Maybe physical or emotional.
So the question was that people who are apparently devoted and devotees and good devotees appear to be suffering psychologically, physically. So how is this a reward when it seems that they're encountering all sorts of adversity? Is that a fair way to rephrase your question? So this is a very good point because we see it all around us, adversity. And sometimes people say, there can't be a God, because why does God let tsunamis happen? Why does God let trade towers topple and thousands of people die? Why do they die in earthquakes in Maharashtra and various places? How can there be God? How can there be suffering if a person is surrendered to Krishna? How is there reward? Well, what I was saying before is that awards are not limited to this lifetime or this body. Sometimes it seems very cruel that people have to die very young. Sometimes babies die. Sometimes very young people encounter great misfortune. Why does this happen? It is misfortune, and it is unfortunate, and certainly a devotee who is soft-hearted like Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita didn't want to fight against his relatives. They exhibit all these good qualities of not wanting anyone to suffer and feeling the suffering as if it were their own. This is called paradukha-dukhi in Sanskrit, that a Vaishnava feels the suffering of others as his own. But there's a saying, and this is not maybe, it's a bit of a gross saying. I think it's from one of the management gurus who said that We don't want to give people fish to eat, but we want to teach them how to fish. So, this is a very coarse way of saying that there's an essential element that if people can learn to devote themselves to God, then this is the best service that they can give to humankind. So how does that work? Why is there suffering? Well, suffering and not suffering entails understanding what we are and how long we have to live, and that there is a soul, and that there is such a thing as transmigration, and that there is such a thing as karma and karmic reaction. Once one has understood that I may have to leave prematurely, this can be understood to be a blessing. Because for a devotee, a blessing may be, a curse may be a blessing in disguise. Prabhupada gave this example, I can give you. The cat sometimes picks up a rat, and cats and rats are enemies. So the rat feels that the hot jaws of the cat is death. But if the cat picks up the kitten by the nape of the neck, the kitten feels the cat's hot breath as a warm caress. So this is an example of something that could be very fearsome, the jaws of a creature being seen as a blessing. So for a devotee, and Queen Kunti prays like this in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the first canto, 8th chapter, she prays for more and more adversity to be heaped upon her because she says, then I can remember your lotus feet. So it is a blessing if we can remember Krishna, if we can remember God and perform devotional service even when we are in difficulty. So there's a saying that a sadhu, Diksha Karunaka, is not only tolerant but merciful. When we're in an adverse condition, we generally don't want to talk to anybody. But a person who has developed good qualities will be willing not only to talk to people, but to care for them, to be concerned about their needs and their interests and their situation. So it's a different consciousness, really, for one who is a devotee, that apparent adversities and difficulties are blessings in disguise. They may appear to be adversities, but they are blessings in disguise.